Oops. I'm glad that we gathered here for this meeting to be together for an hour or and a half or so as investigative Sangha and supportive Sangha. Welcome, Reut and Anel and Tovana staff, and thank you that you initiated this meeting, and without you, it couldn't be. Welcome, Carmel. I'm very, very glad that you agreed to host this meeting again together with me. And of course, welcome, Stephen. For those of us who do not know Stephen, Stephen Batchelor has been a monk for 10 years in the tradition of the Tibetan Buddhism and Zen Buddhism. And his renowned authority and the unique voice on the field of Dharma and Buddha teachings, best known for his secular or agnostic approach to Buddhism, Stephen was one of the first teachers to come to Israel to lead a Vipassana retreat as part of Tovana. I think it was in 1991. Is known for his view of the Dharma as a culture of awakening. It is expression which I really love, that is constantly evolving and not a religious system based on dogmas or fixed beliefs. And I think I wish this meeting would be all a lot around this thing about dogmas and fixed beliefs, even in the Dharma field. I would like also to mention that Stephen is the writer of many books, among them Buddhism Without Beliefs, which Carmel and myself have translated
Awesome.
some years ago to Hebrew, Confession of a Buddhist Atheist, Verses from the Center, which is a beautiful poetic translation and commentary on parts of Nagarjuna's famous work. That its name I cannot pronounce. Stephen, maybe you want to say the name of the mullah, and many others great books. Few weeks ago, I think it was three weeks ago, Stephen was here with us in a Zoom meeting. With the Israeli Sangha, Zoom, which many of us found to be a very meaningful and thought-provoking, and I hope and trust that this one will be as well. Stephen, I'm really happy to see you again and really appreciate your willingness to be here with us today. Again, thank you.
Thank you, Eran.
Just
Likewise.
to
Oh,
say a
sorry.
kind of a technical note, public Zoom meetings sometimes have disconnections, and sometimes there are also external interference of bots. And if you find that the Zoom has been disconnected, simply reconnect with the same link. Today, meeting will be divided into three parts. We'll begin with a period of meditation that Stephen will guide. In the second part, there will be a conversation between Stephen, Carmel, and myself. And on the third part, it will be open for questions from participants. So I think that's about all to begin, and I would like to again, welcome Stephen, and invite you to take us into the meditation.
Thank you very much, Eran and Carmel, for hosting this meeting.
Stephen, I
And
don't hear you.
oh, you don't hear me?
I do.
You should.
I
Can
hear you.
Sorry,
you
it's
hear
my
me?
computer.
Okay. Can you hear me now? Can you hear me now, Eran?
I still don't hear you. I might try headphones.
Okay, but everyone else can hear me.
Yes, we can hear.
Yes.
Yes, okay. All right, so the problem must be somewhere with Eran. I hope that resolves it.
I hear you well now.
Oh, good. Sounds like there's a bit of feedback from somewhere. I'd stop now. Okay.
Yes, and maybe ask all the participants, all the people who are here, to make sure that they are muted so that we don't get the background noise from their homes.
Yes, thank you. Yes, we'd be grateful if you could switch off your mics and mute. So let's start again. Thank you very much, Eran, for your warm introduction. And thank you also to Carmel, the two of you, for being willing to host this meeting. We're going to start with a period of meditation. And I'm aware that all of you have a practice of some kind. And if you prefer, just do whatever practice you feel is appropriate in this space and time, and ignore what I say. Otherwise, I will just give a few pointers, really, that might just help us collectively ground ourselves in a similar way. Let's begin simply by finding a comfortable posture and letting our attention come to rest in the natural rhythm of our breath. And making sure that that breath is something that's observed right down into the pit of our stomach, into our diaphragm. Feeling the whole breath, the tidal rhythm of our life, and the life of all beings. If you get distracted, then just gently come back to the breath, to this moment, and start afresh. Let's try and allow this awareness of our breathing to establish within us a non-reactive attention, an attention that is settled, that is still, that is balanced, that is collected. And has the freedom to not be caught up in the reactivity of our thoughts, our emotions, our memories, our plans. But whatever comes up in our mind, to just allow that to be, to notice it come, remain for a while, and then fade away. So opening up a presence of mind that is grounded and non-reactive. So staying with the breath, but at the same time, noticing that this mindful space is a non-reactive space. And this non-reactive space is not the goal or the end of our practice of the Dharma. It is the beginning. It's the space from which we seek to respond to the situations of life that we find ourselves in, rather than to react automatically, compulsively, habitually. Be able to see more clearly from this space in a way that allows us the possibility of another response. Perhaps a more appropriate response. So thank you for your attention. And now we'll begin the period of conversation, initially with Eran, Carmel, and myself. And then in the third part of this meeting, we'll open up the dialogue to everyone.
Well, thank you very much, Stephen, for being here. Thank you, Eran. Thank you, Aner. Before I pass it on to Eran, I thought that we might begin by taking a short pause just to acknowledge the tremendous suffering on all sides in this round of conflict, in this round of violence, once again between Israelis and Palestinians, to acknowledge the grief for all lives lost, injured, affected, and to acknowledge the pain and the concern for all those whose close ones are missing or kidnapped and their fate is unknown.
Thank you for that, Carmel. I would like to begin with a kind of, how to call it, kind of full disclosure. I have views and I hold opinions. They naturally influence what I think and feel. And they certainly influence what I will say today. It is clear to me that my words will derive or at least be influenced by my views. And I will try to have some room around them as much as I can. And still I know that some of my views are different than some of my friends and might be challenging for some of the listeners. So if I'll hurt anyone, I really like to apologize in advance. Mentioning my friends, I find a variety of opinions around my friends, and I'm talking mainly about my Dharma friends. Regarding what might be called the situation, the tragedies of the war, both in Gaza and in Israel, questions regarding citizens of Gaza, questions regarding the Israelis who are all the hostages, and many others. I would say that most of my Dharma friends express traditional positions. No war, stop war now, peace now, ceasefire now. It's not true to all of us. And I may say that I myself find myself asking, are these kind of voices appropriate responses? Or maybe it became habitual. For me, I found that it was kind of my habitual reaction. And now I find myself a lot more in the unknown for voices like unconditional ceasefire now. Of course, it's a legitimate view and it might be appropriate, but I'm not sure. And I want to say that this diversity of voices and opinions among Dharma friends is not self-evident. This was not always the case. Personally, I find in it certain beauty, a sense of graduation. I admit that setting into the narrow range of political and social positions, as it always has been the case, at least in the Israeli Dharma scene, and I believe it's the true. Maybe Stephen, you would like to touch it on the Western Dharma in general, has bothered me occasionally. Do the Buddha's teaching lead necessarily to leftist liberal attitudes? Or is it that only or mostly people with leftist liberal orientation are attracted to the Dharma? And if so, what does it mean? And what would the Buddha say about the situation? Would he say anything? Stevens, I guess I would like to elaborate and try to shed some light on the subject regarding kind of this abstract question, what the Buddha say? But and maybe we'll use it next with a beautiful sutta that once you have taught me. But maybe I'll stop here and I'll be happy to have your response, mainly to those questions regarding the place of diversity of opinions and responses coming from non-reactive ground.
Thank you, Eran. That was very beautifully, and I think very heartfeltly said. And I can resonate with everything that you were talking about. I share the same ambivalence, let's say, around the issues of particularly pacifism, that Buddhism is somehow a knee-jerk pacifism, and that a right-thinking practitioner of the Dharma would be one who would find no grounds for tolerating violence. You ask, what would the Buddha have said? This is a sort of hypothetical thought experiment that often comes out in moments like this. Of course, we can't really say. It's a thought experiment. But we can go back to some of the earliest texts in the Pali Canon, which I think gives us some sense of where he may have stood on these issues. And in the Sanyutta Nikaya, the connected discourses, you have a sequence of about 25 sutta texts, which are essentially dialogues with King Pasenadi of Kosala. King Pasenadi of Kosala was basically the ruler of the land in which the Buddha grew up, namely Kosala. Sakya, which was literally the place that he was born and eventually left home, had by the time of his birth, and we can see this in the Pali texts, been incorporated into the kingdom of Kosala. And Kosala was essentially an autocratic monarchy, whereas Sakya had been a small-scale oligarchic republic. And this kingdom had been created to a large extent by the use of force, the use of standing armies, that the same surplus and affluence that had enabled men and women to go forth into the homeless life and live by arms, which means that there is a surplus of production that can help, that can provide for non-laboring people, was also the condition that gave rise to standing armies. In other words, warlords and kings were able to employ men to, always be active in military service. And these were expansive kingdoms, they sought to take in more and more territory. And at the Buddha's time, he was basically caught. He was involved in the activities of the two principal kingdoms, Kosala to the north, with its capital at Shravasti or Savatthi, and Magadha in the south of the Ganges, which was ruled by a man called Bimbisara. Now, there are a number of occasions in these dialogues where King Pasenadi tells the Buddha that he's had to execute people. He's been involved in putting down an uprising. All of those examples come up. The Buddha listens to him, but he never tells him to refrain from violence. His usual response is, "Great king, you must do as you see fit." In other words, rather surprisingly, perhaps, from the standpoint of a lot of modern Western Buddhism, the Buddha doesn't try to dissuade him from acting with military force or violence, but he seeks to empower the king through his teachings to make the appropriate judgments. That it is the responsibility of the king to maintain the security of his realm, to provide for the safety of people, just as it is in our day. And the Buddha provides him with moral guidelines and principles and forms of practice, and puts the responsibility on the political leader to make those judgments, and doesn't condemn him or blame him or chastise him for doing those things that are built into his realm of responsibility. Now, it's true that a lot of my friends in the Dharma scene are effectively left-leaning liberal people who have a strong pacifist predilection, and I respect that very much. I think it's important in all societies that certain members of the society take a strong moral stand against violence. But what has happened recently in the United Kingdom, I don't know how many of you are following the recent political developments in England, but we've had a Home Secretary called Suella Braverman. She's a lady from, she was born in England, but her parents are both Indian, ethnically. And she's been chastised in the left-leaning press for having a very inappropriate, a very overly reactive stance against migrants coming in from France. This you may not think of as such an unusual thing, except Suella Braverman happens to be a Buddhist, and not a Buddhist by birth. In other words, she doesn't come from a Buddhist family, and so she's a sort of cultural Buddhist or a sort of a Buddhist by tradition. She chose to become a Buddhist, and she's a member of the Triratna Order in London. She converted to Buddhism relatively recently. She's involved not in an Asian ethnic form of Buddhism, but in a modern Western form of Buddhism, founded by a man called Sangharakshita. Very big in England now. And most of my friends in that organization would also be probably predominantly pacifist. And I find it actually very challenging to have one of the most prominent Buddhists in the land serving as the Home Secretary, or until she was fired a few days ago for being too extreme for the Conservatives. And many of my friends are horrified by this. But I have to admit, I have a certain admiration and respect for her. I'm very, very happy, just as on a slightly different tangent, that we have a Buddhist minister in the government. Her views are probably quite different from my own, but she's an extraordinarily intelligent woman, and I think a person of great integrity. And yet she's taking decisions, or she would like to take decisions, that I personally would probably disagree with. So her example, I think, like Eran was mentioning, somehow points to Buddhism or the Dharma as a tradition that is able to include a diversity of views. And I feel that if we go back also to some of the earlier teachings, the Buddha is constantly talking about how we get caught up in views and opinions. And a left-wing, liberal, pacifist view can also be an entrenched opinion that is inflexible, intolerant, and unable to accept what other, let alone other people, other Buddhists might be saying. And I feel that a secular Buddhism is a Buddhism that actually operates within a sphere of tolerance. The Dalai Lama wrote a book some years ago called Beyond Religion, which is strange coming from a man who is the head of a world religion, more or less. And he bases this, his view of being beyond religion on the Indian constitution, which is a secular constitution founded by Bhimrao Ambedkar, another political leader in India, who was born as an untouchable, a Dalit, and converted to Buddhism, as I'm sure many of you are familiar, in order to free his people from the what he feels to be the cruelty of the Indian caste system. And Ambedkar was charged by Nehru with drawing up the constitution for modern India. And Ambedkar specifically framed it as a secular society, but he didn't understand secular to mean against religion. He understood secularity as a space of tolerance within which all religions could coexist peacefully. I'm very sympathetic to that view. And I think we maybe need to put the principle of tolerance back in the center position here, to have the openness and the non-reactivity of mind, to recognize, even if we don't agree, with diverse opinions and views, and see that the problem in so many ways is not the views and the opinions that in their own right, but our attachment and our our commitment to them, our holding on to them firmly, which automatically sets up a binary situation. You know, we're right, you're wrong. We're good, you're bad. And so much of the inflamed language around the current crisis in your country triggers precisely those kinds of intolerant binary positions. And I think that that is what makes some of these issues seem so intractable, that we're unwilling to let go of our attachment to our views, which is not the same as of letting go of the views themselves. The views could have a function, a workability, and they may be providing possibilities and options that all people could benefit from. And also through dialogue, we may be able to release our hold on them and be able to appreciate better where other people, our opponents, are coming from.
Thank you for that wide and deep response. And Carmel, is it okay that I'll continue for a moment just to elaborate in that?
Well, okay. I actually also have a question that follows on, but go
please,
ahead.
Please.
Yeah. You talk about the binarism. And one of the greatest challenges for me today is that for the first time in my life, I have the experience of being an object of blind hatred. You know, I never really believed Hamas mean to wipe us out. I knew that it was in their charter, but I never really appreciated what that they were serious about this. And I never, until now, understood the Islamist culture of death. These are views. I never appreciated to what extreme degree they actually seem to value death over the value of life. And they are willing to sacrifice not just their armed fighters, but also their people in the cause of what they call a holy war. And on top of that, it seems like there's no one to talk to. If we want to break the cycle of violence, if we want to strive for some kind of negotiated resolution of the conflict, whether in the future, far or near, you need to have somebody to talk to. So, what my question is, what skills can the practice of Dharma offer us for meeting and living with these conditions?
Well, I have to admit, I'm a bit out of my depth here. Unlike you, I haven't experienced being the object of unconditional hatred simply because of the person I happen to be, my race, for example. On the other hand, I don't know whether I mentioned this last time we spoke, but when we had the 50th anniversary of D-Day some years ago in England, I was living in England then. I remember walking along the river near where we lived and seeing the remains of one of the landing craft that had been had been used in the D-Day invasions. And I became very conscious at that moment of how my freedoms to lead the life I have led in England are dependent upon thousands and hundreds of thousands of young men, mainly young women too, who gave their lives so that I could enjoy these freedoms. So, in other words, I recognize that yes, there was a regime in Germany, as of course you know only too well, that sought to eliminate those it did not tolerate. How do you tolerate those who cannot tolerate? And in the case of the Second World War, that is what in many ways led to the violence, led to the war itself. Which, fortunately for all of us, the Allies were victorious. And so to put oneself back at that time in 1939, say, would I have taken a pacifist stance? Would I have said, no, violence is wrong? If Hitler invades, well, that's just our bad karma. I don't think so, frankly. Something also Nelson Mandela says in his autobiography. He says, we tried nonviolence. In fact, the ANC, the African National Congress, were very much influenced by Gandhian principles of nonviolence at the beginning. But they found that the apartheid regime in South Africa, they didn't that didn't have any effect at all. And then Mandela concludes, he says, we turned to violence. Because we felt there was really no other alternative. But he also said, it would have been unethical not to have resorted to violence under those circumstances. And that remark really struck me quite deeply, because Mandela is raised up as this great saintly figure. But he recognized that actually, under certain conditions, where you are dealing with someone who is simply not, with whom you cannot negotiate, that for him, violence was an ethical response. It was a moral response.
Stephen, may I say something? I really remember this sentence of Mandela, and it really inspired me as well. And it supported for years my reflections about the PLO, the Palestinian Liberation Organization, the roots of what is definitely seen by them, freedom fighters. And yet, referring to what Carmel was asking, now to dealing with the Hamas and doctrine, which its violence come from another root, I know that what you said want to say that there is sometimes there is a room for violence, and yet there is kind of the ungraspable violence that coming from idealism. Talking about metta and compassion, remembering the humanity of all people. We mean a lot of time, I mean, that all people just want to live happy life and not to suffer. And if I heard Carmel well, she referred to the fact that there are people that kind of, it's holy grail is death. How can we understand it and deal with it? I hope I was clear.
No, you're very clear. I'm very, very wary about making generalized statements about Islam, which is a religion I do not know well. And I have been accused in the past of making anti-Islamic statements of a very similar nature to what is coming up, that there's something built into the philosophy, the religion of Islam, that seems to have a kind of, you know, an acceptance of death and a kind of unconditional willingness to resort to violence to achieve one's ends. Many of, you know, Muslim friends of mine resist that kind of language very, very much. I think it's more complicated than that, and I'd be very careful about somehow depicting Islam itself as somehow inherently violent. The Christians have done that for a while. And also historically, of course, Islam was to a large extent responsible for the destruction of Buddhism in India and in Central Asia. Christianity is responsible for the destruction of Greek philosophy in the West too. So monotheistic faiths, I think, is perhaps the bigger problem. Namely, a monotheism is one that in some senses is premised on the idea that what we believe to be good is revealed or taught by a God who has no equal. And I think that that's that kind of attitude is certainly there in Islam, it's there in Christianity, and I suspect it's there in Judaism as well. And my problem with a Buddhist really is to question the very fundamental tenet of monotheism. And as we know, I mean, the Middle East has been a hotbed of conflict between the monotheistic faiths, the Jews, the Christians, the Muslims. They've all been fighting over Jerusalem and the Holy Land, you know, for centuries. And I wonder if this has not got more to do with monotheism than it does with either Islam or with Christianity or with Judaism. But again, I'm really, this is not an area where I really have much knowledge or competence. So I take what I say with a pinch of salt.
I need to comment on that. These faiths or religions, they also contain a diversity of views.
Mm-hmm.
Islamists are not Muslims. These are different ideas. And even within the Islamists, we might find different strains of beliefs and views and opinions. So we also have our own, in Israel, extremist, violent, you might call them fundamentalists. So I think that we need to be aware. I think that it's very important, especially when we're talking about the middle way. And it's these extreme views that sort of they baffle. And I think that the whole world, it's not just Israel, we will have to learn how to deal with these kinds of views among us.
No, thank you. No, I agree. And again, I didn't really pick up clearly enough, perhaps, the difference between the Islamists and Muslims in general. But in some senses, the Islamists are the fundamentalists, as you say, within Islam, and you'll find similar fundamentalisms within not only monotheisms, you'll find them also in Buddhism too. Buddhism has been used to justify wars in Sri Lanka, for example, recently, in Japan, where I am now, in the Second World War. So I think any ideology probably can be utilized, we might say twisted, but it can be utilized to justify an extreme position. And when people feel under existential threat, there is an enormous temptation to revert to an extremist ideology. Again, it's attractive and very appealing to, you know, look for a middle way position. And I think that does have, you know, intellectually a lot of appeal, a lot of power. But it's one thing to, as it were, hold that kind of principle. It's another thing to actually act from that position wisely and compassionately in a situation in which you're dealing with people who hold extreme views. You know, the reality is Buddhism, with all its middle way philosophy, was unable to resist the double attack from fundamentalist Hinduism and the Islamic invasions of the Indian subcontinent. It was wiped out. So it doesn't. Buddhism doesn't have a particularly good track record on this front. And to me, it's a great question, and a question for which I don't really have an answer, is how would a Buddhist wisely and compassionately, from a middle way perspective, seek to help work towards a resolution of this crisis? I don't know, to be honest. And not being in that situation like you are, I don't know whether I really, you know, have the insights or the kind of the emotional depth to be really able to engage with those questions. I'm too far removed. I live a privileged life, which up until now has not been subjected to those kinds of threats that you are being subject to now. Obviously, and these almost sound like platitudes, we need to create an open space in which to reflect and to discuss and to meditate on these positions and so forth. And all of that is obviously true. But when you get to a situation where you are faced with the potential of your, not only your own personal death, but the death of those whom you love, your fellow people in your country, that raises the whole thing to a whole other level. And as a Buddhist, I would not take a stance of unconditional non-violence. I think that would be a cop-out, frankly.
Yes, Stephen, thank you for your honesty and humility. And I want to go to different track also to cover some other material, though I find it very interesting. I would just add another comment to for the complication of the situation. The talking about extremists, and the will of the Israeli forces to fight extremists, so many people in Gaza suffer, and as well the Israeli Jewish extremists, mostly in the West Bank, and what happens there. And again, as you say, how can we accommodate other views and yet be very clear and real that there are views that we cannot accommodate in this situation? It's so complicated. But as I said, I want to go now to another area. And I think I'll read a question that one of my students has asked me, and I want you to refer to. I did respond, but I really would be happy to hear your response. Just a moment, I'll find it. Here it is. She said, I'm going through one of the hardest periods of my life. Everything seems to collapse, and I feel like I've really failed. I tried very hard, and I did a lot of work, but I couldn't rise up and be a better version of myself. I really tried, but except maybe for very short periods of time, I couldn't see the positive, couldn't be grateful, I couldn't open my heart. A lot of existential question came up, a lot of things that I believed in about myself, a lot of things I believed in about human beings were blasted, became like dust. I wish not to be attached, but I just want to be at home, to return to what I know and what I'm used to, and to my safe place and my comfort zone. I remember the teaching of the hindrances of guests and wish to see them and not to be under the spell, but just have to find myself restless, angry, and full of doubts. I wish not to suffer because I'm getting what I want. I wish to embrace suffering, but I hate it and neurotically look for a way out. And alongside all of that, there is also a very great sense of disappointment in myself. I hope it's because I'm just a beginner and that I'll be a better place in better place in the future when I'll be more experienced and seasoned practitioner. But at the moment, I'm going through one of the hardest periods of my life. And to add to it, kind of a picture from my experience. Well, while we are dealing with so much, I say we, I think many people that I know and talk to, and I believe many others in Israel and Gaza, unwelcome thoughts and emotions that we are not proud of, that we thought are not anymore part of our inner arena. And as practitioners, it might be very challenging. To give a small example, as you know, I live in the north, and every day I hear at least dozen, if not two dozens, of booms of blasts. Very rarely it's of a missile that landed in Israel, because these ones are landing normally far away from where I live. Just few of them are close by, and most of the booms I hear, it's of missiles that the Israeli troops are shooting to Lebanon. And after a while, the ear get used and learn to say the different. It's a slightly different sound. And what I'm realizing is that when I hear a blast, that means that a missile just landed, I'm shrinking. I'm threatened. I'm feeling like in surviving, like someone trying to attack me. I'm shrinking, but the initial of this system, it's shrinking. And when I realized that this blast, and it's so much similar, is of a missile that was shot from Israel, the initial response is kind of a relief. And then came the thought, what, you feel a relief to think that someone is now... So taking that and taking all this beautiful woman was saying, I want to ask you to say a few words about the sense of being a Buddhist failure.
The Buddhist failure is I've written of my own experience as a Buddhist failure.
Yeah, I remember you were reading about.
But when you read out this person's reflection, to me, it was not a voice of failure that I heard at all. I felt she had touched within herself a level of self-awareness and honesty and understanding and groundedness that she'd probably never had before. And yet she was judging it in terms of Buddhism, let's say, what she'd been, you know, told that she should be doing. Frankly, I think her, and what it sounded like was a confession, really. It was very moving, very truthful, very real. And surely that's what the Dharma is about. It's not about leading a life in which you support yourself with all manner of fine-sounding spiritual platitudes. She'd seen through that, in a way. Again, I'm just a beginner. We're all just beginners. She's not alone. And again, I think that's another, it's another fantasy we have, that somehow when you practice the Dharma, you somehow get, you know, you get to be a better person, you know, by definition. You do it for 20 years, you have all of these values much more realized in your life than others. That may be true to some degree, I agree. But the point is, when the shit hits the fan, like I think last time I mentioned the story I was told by my Tibetan friends, that, you know, when the Chinese rockets started landing in the monasteries, it was only at that point that you really knew who somehow was, you know, could handle that and who couldn't. And you couldn't have made those judgments 24 hours earlier. That it's...
If I may say something, uh-huh. I so much agree, and what you're saying is resonating in me, and I definitely think these words and this question is not... expression of a failure, though she feels so. And then she said she heard what you said then about the Tibetans, and you could know whoever the Dharma is deep inside him and who is just a sort of belief. And she said, if I feel so, the Dharma is not deep inside me. And I hope what you're saying now will make it clearer that the Dharma is not what we think about it and the way that we imagine that we're gonna function on be in a certain situation. It's just a thought, it's just an idea.
Yeah, I can. I mean, it's true. I think, one could have, I could have given that impression. Again, maybe the example of the Tibetans, is true to some extent. But in my own response to that person and hearing, the way she articulates that, it's not so much the content of what she says, but the passion and the honesty with which she said it. With that example of the Tibetans, it was more a question of the fact that certain people just gave up and they killed themselves at that time. They could see no future at all. They saw no possibility of hope. And I hope that the person who said those things has not, as it were, lapsed into a state of complete despair. That's, I feel, where, in a way, you could well feel, as it were, that the Dharma has been a complete failure for you. Your practice has been worthless, and that leaves you in a state of despair. And not knowing the person, I cannot judge that, obviously. But the way in which it was articulated did not strike me as the voice of despair.
No, you're so right. You're so right. Its response was, after saying all of that, writing to me, corresponding, she got to her Sangha and said, "Sangha, let's meet. I need you. I want to be together."
Yeah, exactly.
So maybe we can take that up, because we're going to open for questions to the audience. But I was wondering about the role of Sangha in times like this. And among other things, besides the hatred that we are now experiencing, we are also experiencing political prejudice. Eran mentioned earlier, especially among the quote-unquote left, the quote-unquote progressive left. And I find that even among Dharma friends from other countries, I sometimes hear a failure to comprehend. They sort of they're glossing over the violence, blaming Israel as the one responsible for acting in self-defense, and applying a double standard that sometimes reeks of anti-Semitism. And I hear similar concerns from Dharma friends in other countries who are also Jewish. So there's this, you mentioned it earlier, this inability to hold the complexity of the suffering and responsibility on all sides of the conflict, noting that there are numerous forces at play on the global level. Okay, so it is a very complex and fragile situation. So experiencing that prejudice can be a silencing. It makes me feel uncomfortable when I meet that prejudice in person. It makes me hesitate to speak out. It makes me hesitate to share the things that concern me. And I was wondering whether you could sort of address what might be an appropriate response to prejudice of that is ignorant, essentially. It's a prejudice that stems from ignorance. And what is the time of Sangha? What is the function of Sangha in times like this, locally and across the world?
Well, I think if something is coming from ignorance, then clearly the response has to do with finding ways to dispel that ignorance. Yeah, and again, that's the easy thing to say, but to do it in practice is difficult because there is very much entrenched opinion. And I see, I mean, here in Japan, it's so remote that people, it's not really, these issues are not on people's radar at all. But I'm following, I read the British press, the left press, I read The Guardian every day. And again, I find myself, especially having had these conversations with you, I can't just follow that line anymore. It strikes me that, you know, when Hamas launched its brutal attack against the Israelis in near their border and killed 1,500 people, it knew full well that Israel wasn't just going to sit back and do nothing. They knew that Israel would launch massive attack, and they knew that thousands of their people would die. I think it's, I really don't get how at the moment in the left press, certainly in Britain, that idea is sort of paid lip service to, as a kind of an opening, you know, acknowledgement of this terrible attack. But now all the blame is going on Israel. And yet, surely, the primary responsibility for what is happening has to be laid at the feet of those who launched that initial outrage and murder in the South, knowing full well, or having a fairly good idea of what consequences that would bring. And presumably they want these consequences. Hamas wants the world to take a stance against Israel. In that case, effectively, the left is playing into the hands of Hamas in that sense. That's my personal feeling. And of course, I think the real danger is now that this situation could begin to escalate into a wider and wider conflict in which the big superpowers will be drawn in. And then, you know, we're all in this. Of course, I the idea that, you know, hundreds of thousands of children are being killed in Gaza is horrifying. I mean, that's it, but it's not something that I think one can exclusively place the blame on Israel for. I tend to agree that if there were a long ceasefire, that would be something that Hamas would use to its advantage. And at the same time, I'm not a political animal. I've never been active politically. I really do sympathize with those who are having to make these decisions in Israel, even if I don't agree with their politics, because
and
I think this is.
And the role of
Sanger, well, I think we cannot address issues such as this just by ourselves as individuals. I think unless you are an exceptionally gifted speaker or activist or something, I feel we have to work together. And that to me seems crucial. And what Eran said about his friend who in a sense brought this issue into her Sangha, that I think we can maybe use this terrible time as a means of strengthening the bonds of commitment with each other as a body of people who share deep common concerns about these issues. And that means talking, it means really allowing ourselves to be totally frank and honest, trying to inform ourselves as best we possibly can in this arena of so much disinformation from all sides. One would hope that perhaps if something good comes out of this, it might be the strengthening of our bonds of community with those with whom we feel closest and with whom we and those we love. And I would hope that this conversation can extend beyond the Buddhist Sangha in Israel. I haven't had much, I've been out in the Far East during all of this time, so I haven't really had much contact with my fellow Sangha members in Britain or Europe around this issue. So I don't know quite where things are lie at the moment.
Thank you, Stephen. I have some more questions and some more subjects that I love to explore with you, but I'm aware of the time, and I'll be happy to open it for participants who would like to ask you a question or say something that would like your response. So if anybody like to ask Stephen anything, please unmute yourself and say whatever you like. Ask whatever you like.
If you don't feel comfortable speaking on the screen, then send a text either to Eran or to Carmel, or to me if you want.
Well, I see that someone has sent a question. In the spirit of pluralism of views in the Dharma on the subject of violence and politics, I have a feeling of deep irrelevance towards all opinions. It's like views are almost equally untuned and thus irrelevant. But that leaves me
irrelevant, I think is the
irrelevant,
word.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But that leaves me with a sense of detachment, and that is unpleasant.
I think to respond to that, the Buddha uses the word views in a somewhat ambiguous way. You'll find passages where he is very critical of views and opinions. And in fact, some texts are basically seem to be saying the only way to really find any freedom in this world is to let go of all views and opinions. The Atthakavagga, for example, is very strong in this renunciation of all views and opinions. But then you also find that the first element of the Eightfold Path is Samadhi, is right view, same word. And so clearly he's using the word ditti there in a totally positive way. And I think what we have to differentiate is between views and opinions that actually close us down, that prevent us having any real communication with others, and a view of the world. I'd almost prefer to use the word a perspective, but let's stay with the word view, because that is the word he uses, ditti. And a ditti that can give birth to a way of life that resolves conflict. In reality, I don't think it's possible as a human being to live without views and to have views and opinions about things. I don't think that's doable. Even if you have, Nagarjuna, again, also sort of suggests that we can just get rid of all views. But at the same time, to have no view is a view. To have no views and opinions is also a view, that somehow to not have views and opinions of that nature is good, and there it is, it's a view again. No views is a good view. So we have to be a little bit careful in demonizing all views on the one hand, and thereby somehow arguing that any view, any standpoint is irrelevant. I can't accept that. And I don't think the Buddha would certainly have said anything along those lines. But let's look into the earlier text. What does he say this right view is? Well, one, if you look at, there is a text called the Samaditi Sutta, the Discourse on Right View. It's the middle length sayings number 9. You can look it up. And what is the first? He lists a whole bunch of things. But as is often the case with these texts, I think they grow over time. And probably the top of the list is the one we need to pay most attention to. So the first thing he states, in fact, I don't think it's the Buddha, it's Sariputta, but same thing. The first thing he says is the right view is to be able to judge between what is skillful and what is unskillful. That's samadhi. It's got nothing to do with holding opinions about what's true or false. It has to do with being able to make a judgment that is skillful as opposed to unskillful. In other words, it's ethical. Samadhi is a capacity for being able to make appropriate judgments in terms of what you then subsequently say or do. So, in other words, it's not a dogmatic view in any sense at all. It's got nothing to do with dogmas or beliefs. It has to do with the training of our, what we might call our inner moral compass. And that's the skill that we seek to cultivate on the path. It's the skill of learning to attune ourselves through trial and error, through getting things wrong, making mistakes, learning from our successes and the successes of others in such a way that we get a clearer and more grounded sense in our own capacity to make appropriate judgments. The other text that is crucial to the understanding of right view is called the Kacchanagota Sutta, the Discourse to Kacchanagota. It's in the connected discourses, and it's also the text that Nagarjuna bases his entire philosophy on. And there he's asked, what is samadhiti, what is right view? And he says, right view is a view in which we are no longer caught up in the binary distinction between is and is not, ati and nati, being and non-being. In other words, right view is a view that has transcended a commitment to binary opposites, to dualism. I don't like the word dualism. I prefer binary thinking. So in other words, again, it's not a dogmatic view about something. It's not holding an opinion about something. It's actually an encouragement to practice and lead your life in a certain way in which you become increasingly suspicious and wary of binary oppositions, good versus evil, right versus wrong, and how that so easily concretizes into, irreconcilable conflicts between people. So that seems to be how this understanding of ditti, samaditti, complete view, is one that is on the one hand ethical and on the other hand very much alert to the dangers of binary thinking, which is, of course, the middle way. That's where the middle way really comes in as well.
Thanks, Stephen. I see that Bracha is waving, wanting to ask a question.
Well, thank you very much, Bracha. To the extent that I can, I can feel very much in sympathy with your, obviously, finding yourself in an incredibly difficult situation. And I wonder sometimes whether hope is actually the right word. I suppose it is, really. It's the opposite of despair, really. I mean, we lose the phonetic distinction, the etymological distinction in English, but désespoir is hopelessness, and hope is the opposite of that. And perhaps the two of them stand out perhaps as binaries. In other words, they might both have an element of, something, hope and despair lie at different ends of the of a spectrum, as is the case with all binaries, good and bad, right and wrong. Hope, despair would also be elements of a binary. So again, it may not, to invest too much in the notion of hope is perhaps to swing too far towards that extreme, just as others will swing too far back to the other swing, despair. Can we find a middle way? That, I think, would probably be what would come out of some of these early Buddhist teachings. It's about, you know, not being naively optimistic on the one hand, but also not being totally pessimistic either on the other, but finding the fact that there, you know, what we hope for deep down may not be something that we can actually realistically achieve. But on the other hand, that doesn't mean that all is lost. And we may have to recalibrate our sense of, you know, what our life is going to be like and that of our community is going to be like. That may entail making certain compromises, that may entail, you know, gaining and preserving certain elements of what we value, but also perhaps having to accept that other elements will be lost. But not having been in such a situation myself, as you are, I really do not feel I have much moral authority to speak about this. And when I hear myself speaking, I hear it's my inner Buddhist theologian is speaking. And I'm very much aware that I don't experience what you're experiencing. That might give me a little advantage in having a bit of distance that might be helpful. But in many ways, this is your struggle to come to terms with hope and despair. And maybe to consider it in terms of finding some sort of middle ground between the two, to have certain things that we can still hope for, and also perhaps at times to accept that at other levels, things are maybe going to change in ways that we'll lose something that we value, and to be able to hold the two. Because hope can often be naive, I think, and it can be wishful thinking. That, I think, is a danger with it. The same issue comes up in discussions about the climate crisis as well. You know, people say, you know, I have no hope for my children in the future. I won't have kids. The future is going to be terrible. I'm losing hope. Joanna Macy wrote a book called Active Hope that addresses this, I think, in some ways. But that's focused primarily on environmental issues. Someone mentioned gratitude. It flashed up on my screen a moment ago. I think look at hope and despair also within the framework of other values, that hope is not a value in and of, it's not something that exists in its own right, but it's part of a complex of values. And again, I think Buddhism often presents moral values not in isolation, but as clusters. You know, the five hindrances and the five strengths and the seven factors of enlightenment. And people often say, oh, Buddhists like lists, this is boring. But I don't think it is. I think that any virtue, let's say, in shorthand, does not operate in isolation. It operates within a cluster of supportive virtues. And what's more important, really, than, you know, the sort of homing in on one, let's say hope or despair, is to see, well, what is it that actually enables hope? Of what kind of cluster would hope be a part of? There's not really a word in classical Buddhism for hope. The closest that comes to it is something like chanda, which means a sort of a longing, an aspiration. I mean, that's something we can do. We can recognize what it is that we value and what it is that we want to work towards. Hope is often isolated from that, and it's just a kind of an idea that, you know, we hope that it's going to be a much better future, but we haven't really thought through very clearly how we're going to get there. I think aspiration, coupled with, you know, qualities like, you know, focus and discernment and compassion, all of these different virtues clustered together can perhaps be a way of looking at it. Gratitude would certainly be one as well, as it were, to recognize what the, you know, what we're grateful for, what has been good in our lives. To, you know, so all of these elements, I think, have to, you know, be somehow brought together in clusters. My friend Christine Feldman says that talking of mindfulness, she says, mindfulness is a team player. I think that's a very good expression. In other words, they don't operate all by themselves. Some people, you know, absolutize mindfulness. Mindfulness is going to solve all our problems. No, it's not. It operates within a field of virtues, and it doesn't exist independently. And ditto with hope as well, I feel. To try to sort of, in a way, relativize it a bit and see it as part of a package rather than as something that's sort of a standalone virtue. I'm aware of the time. It's 5:30 here in Japan. It must be 5:10 with you. Is that right? I'm fading a bit, I'm afraid. I haven't had a very busy day. I've been looking at art all day. But I realize that it's a Saturday. It's the Shabbat. And I wish you well on this Shabbat. But maybe we should draw things to a close at this point.
Yes, I think so. I think that this time frame is more than enough for the medium. And there are other questions. There was a hand up and there were questions in the chat, and I can say you're welcome to address me or Iran individually. I'm sure you can get the contact details if needed. And to thank you again, Stephen, very much for being with us and bringing that perspective. It's not just historical, it's also this much broader perspective. As you said, there is, well, not being in the thick and thin of things, it also gives perspective, and that is very helpful for us. So thank you very much, Stephen, and thank you, Iran.
Thank you, Carmel.
Thank you, Stephen.
Stephen, can you be with us for one more minute?
Yeah, of course. Yes, I've got nothing to do. I'm just feeling with time.
Yeah, well, the time and it was really full. I just want to conclude to share with a poem that a friend and a colleague, an Israeli Dharma teacher, wrote these days. Its name is War Poem. It's Odilia Perry Weinberg who wrote it. Your heart breaks. Sorrow zips through every organ. The eyes looking up at the sky, the treetops. The ears taking in birdsong, traffic, warplanes. Every sail a home for grief. Grief take no sides. Grief does not know how to count thousands. If one beloved face, 20 years old, smiling straight at the camera, his appetite for a life just starting, clearly shining through his eyes, seems to break you, looking as a mother at this face that from now on will be still framed. It is not because he matters more. Grief and its grave and silent witness ache for all of us. Each moment of living now must be assimilated to make room for the knowing of loss and more loss. Meanwhile, life, it cannot be denied, demands to be lived. It requires coffee and breathing, the surreal machinations of routine, occasional school days for your children, meals, a clean t-shirt. It requires protection. It demands to be dignified by discernment, by the admission of fragility. Life asks that we acknowledge the smallness of our agency and the boundlessness of our love.
Oh, thank you. That was very beautiful.